This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. It's safe to say that Sayreville, New Jersey, is a football town. The high school team captured three state championships in 4 years, and head coach George Najjar is something of an icon, mentor to dozens of kids over the span of his career at Sayreville. Then a month ago, it all came crashing down as seven football players were arrested in a hazing scandal that involves charges of sexual assault. We are having a little bit of difficulty with our phones right now, but in just a moment or so, we hope to bring up Vernal Coleman, who has been covering the story for NJ Advanced Media. His stories also appear in the Star Ledger. But in the meantime, while the phones are down, if you have thoughts about this story, if you have thoughts about hazing in general, why not shoot us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. And I understand that we do have Vernal with us now. Vernal, welcome to Radio Times.
Good morning, Mary. How are you?
Just fine, thanks. So let's get into the story a little bit more, Vernal. The players arrested are all between the ages of 15 and 17. Has the decision been made to treat the three who are facing charges of aggravated sexual assault as adults or as minors?
That decision has not been made, and today is actually the deadline for prosecutor, county prosecutor Andrew Carey, to make that decision. Indications are that he will not. This is a very, well, I wouldn't say very, but a conservative prosecutor who has a history of making sound and, well, just decisions that I don't think that he would necessarily be going out on a limb on. So we will see by the end of business today if any petitions are actually filed. But the indications that I've gotten through my reporting indicate that this will stay in juvenile court.
Okay. So, and what is the sense of the reaction in the community to this as to whether the kids should be charged as adults or as minors?
I think that if you were to speak to people in the community about whether the kids should be charged as minors to a person, they would say that, well, yes, they should. And just in terms of reaction, it's gone through phases since the first news reports, well, since the unearthing of the allegations occurred. People were first very angry, especially in the sort of the vacuum of information where they didn't really know why the season or the game first and the season was being canceled. And there was a lot of anger directed at the man who made that decision, Superintendent Richard Lavie. But I think if you were to speak with them now, those people who were so angry and at the onset of this controversy, simply want now to see justice done. And I think that, yeah, to a person that you would probably find that to be true if you spoke with folks in Sayreville.
Vernal, stories do keep changing about what exactly happened in the locker room. Kids who'd allegedly been victimized have backpedaled. First, they weren't clothed when the hazing happened, and now at least one is saying he was. What is the story as you understand it?
Well, as you indicated, the story continues to change. I think what we're seeing right now is that there is, well, to a certain extent, pressure being that these the four football players, the freshmen who came forward, have been under a lot of pressure, and they are teenagers, and they still have to go into that school every single day. So as I understand it, there are some freshmen who came forward who may be backtracking on the stories and the statements that they've made. And then again, there may not be. We really don't know. And I think all of it is going to eventually come out. But as of right now, there may be some who have backtracked on what they've talked to the prosecutor about. Because remember, these are kids who whose families have been approached by not just one media outlet, but dozens. And in the interim between when this actually gets adjudicated and now, their stories may change their motive, not their motivations, but their inclination to put themselves forward may change a great deal.
Well, so the backlash was ugly. The backlash was ugly, wasn't it?
The backlash has been very ugly. And part of our reporting at NJ Advanced Media has been to try and figure out what exactly is going on with the kids in the school. But I think to a certain extent, they've really gone underground, and that just may be because they're media weary at this point.
And also, too, I would imagine this is directly affecting the criminal investigation.
Exactly. As I said, I don't think the prosecutor would have charged the football player that he did charge if he did not have evidence that he could bring inside a courtroom and prove those charges. And now, again, with all the pressure that's been exuded on these kids, and who knows what's actually being discussed in within their families as to whether or not, going on the stand and accusing their fellow football players or these kids who were once their fellow football players, that there's a lot of stuff that's happened in between now and between when they first approached them and now. So, yeah, it's got to be frustrating for the prosecutors in these kids.
Could you just briefly describe some of what went on in social media against these kids, the freshmen?
Well, as you probably imagine, social media is like a jungle warfare in terms of high schoolers. And even though there were dozens of media outlets rushing across Sayreville to try and confirm or at least speak to the victims and identify who the alleged attackers were, this was all playing out on social media because within the school, the identities of all of those individuals was very much known. And to a certain extent, I think that there was a backlash that played out on social media. And those kids' names, every single one of them, were sort of bandied about through the ether of digital media, Facebook and Twitter and through other means.
At a board meeting, Vernal, in which the football coaches were suspended, some in the crowd argued that more should have been done to train the coaches to prevent bullying. And New Jersey, of course, has an anti-bullying law that's been on the books for about 3 years now. Was there a disconnect here?
There may have been, and it's something that I'm looking into in my own reporting. The anti-bullying law is very complicated, and it places a lot of requirements on individual school districts. And right now, what we're trying to do is ascertain to what extent the Sayreville School District actually complied with the law. Right now, again, we're trying to figure out if those accusations had merit.
Well, the fact is you had kids who and several dozen kids who were left alone in the locker room for extended periods of time. Do I have that correct?
You do have that correct. As has been established, the locker room at Sayreville War Memorial High School is very much separate from the coach's office. And even though they had a staff, a coaching staff of in double digits, apparently, and this has been established through various different means, but apparently the coaches did not spend that much time actually policing the locker room. And I think that's something that has to be addressed by the school board just moving forward.
I'm going to guess that Sayreville is not the only district in which this happens.
Definitely not.
Kids are left alone in locker rooms.
I'd say that's pretty spot on. One thing that I think has come out of this is that other districts, having seen what can possibly result when you have unsupervised young men in a locker room, have probably taken steps at this point. At least I would hope that they have taken steps to address that. Again, the law does not necessarily require there to be supervision inside the locker room explicitly, but I think that what you'll find if you were to take a poll of different districts and football teams or football programs throughout the state of New Jersey is that everyone is taking a very hard look at the supervision of athletes.
Vernal, is this one of those stories where, as a journalist, you find yourself treading carefully? And the reason I ask that is because of the story 8 years ago of the Duke University lacrosse players who were, as it turns out, were falsely accused of rape. But the story just blew up. It was widely reported. They were castigated. The coach was forced to resign. Then it ends up the prosecutor himself was prosecuted because the charges were false.
Yes, I think you have that in the back of your mind, and I actually reported in North Carolina sort of in the aftermath of that, so it's definitely in the back of my mind when I've been reporting this story. And you do have to tread lightly. We're dealing with minors, one, but also you have to doubly verify everything. But I think the specter of the Duke lacrosse case has sort of chastened everybody, especially members of the legal community. There's no prosecutor, I think, whoever wants to go into court with the accusations simply of one witness who maybe that witness statements were not vetted completely, as was, I guess, the case in with the Duke lacrosse story. So you definitely have that in the back of your mind. And again, as you said, it's important to do your due diligence with everything that comes across your desk and every piece of information and report accordingly.
Is there a sense among some in the community that the scandal, that the charges brought are racist, Vernal?
That's a tough question because a lot of times the people who are making those accusations won't go on the record with them. At least that's what I found in my reporting, and some of my colleagues have found the same thing. It's a story that I think has been sort of explored but not nailed down.
And the reason I'm asking, I just want to jump in, is because the young men, to the best of my knowledge, are all African-American, the young men who've been arrested.
That's actually untrue.
Okay.
That's not accurate, I should say. All of the young men who have been charged are not African American, and not all of the alleged victims, as my own reporting and again some of my colleagues' reporting has indicated, are white are Caucasian. So I wouldn't put that much credibility into at this point. The narrative that this was racially motivated. It could very well be, but I just think that is yet to play out and it needs some more research.
Vernal, thank you so much, first of all, for that clarification and for joining us here on Radio Times.
No problem.
Vernal Coleman is reporter for NJ Advanced Media. Coming up after the break, we catch up to New Jersey's anti-bullying law some more. Stuart Green will join us, director of the New Jersey Coalition for Bullying Awareness. And if you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 888-477-9499. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowane. Back in just a moment. This is Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowane. This hour, the focus is on bullying and hazing, and we're going to take a few minutes now to catch up to New Jersey's anti-bullying law, which, as we mentioned, has been on the book for 3 years. Stuart Green is director of the New Jersey Coalition for Bullying Awareness and Prevention. Welcome back to Radio Times, Stuart.
Hello. Thanks, Mary. Appreciate it.
So 3 years in, what sort of grade would you give to the New Jersey Anti-Bullying Bill of Rights?
I think the law has been great and a model for the country in terms of increasing awareness of the importance of the problem and also helping empower parents and kids, especially when kids have been hurt. So I think it's done those two things very well and also done some specific things we could talk about if you want that really help such parents, notably introducing timelines so that schools have to respond to this problems right away rather than take all kinds of amounts of time, which used to be the case. And the other good thing about the law, there's a number of things, is that it really brings the whole issue of culture and climate of schools into play, requiring schools to set up teams to address those issues, and also giving parents a specific identified person to interact with at the school, which was something uncertain for many parents before the law. So the law has done a great job in all those ways, but as with all laws, it's not perfect. It needs modification. There's a task force working on that issue right now in New Jersey.
Well, and Stuart, Governor Christie said about a month ago that the Sayreville scandal does highlight a need for greater education about the law. He says, quote, "The scandal shows everybody that signing laws in of themselves doesn't prevent conduct like the conduct we saw." So is the reality in that it can be extremely difficult to identify and prevent all bullying?
Well, that's true for every single law ever passed. We have laws against murder, and, you know, murders didn't stop immediately. And especially with civil law, as opposed to criminal law, the key is how those laws are implemented, what kinds of structures and funding and other things are put into place to enable the laws. So certainly you pass a law and immediately the behavior doesn't stop, but it can still produce a lot of good things. And indeed, it has.
Let's just take a moment to get your opinion on hazing and bullying. Is all hazing bullying, in your opinion?
Yeah, hazing is a form of bullying. It occurs in specific institutional settings, but that's true of bullying itself. Bullying in general, including hazing, is basically an institutional phenomenon. Bullying and hazing both arise because of the behaviors of the adults who run institutions in which youth function. So whether those institutions are schools or teams or other organizations, it's all bullying, but hazing is a form of it that's very specific to teams and sororities, fraternities, youth organizations. And indeed, there are specific hazing laws in New Jersey and Pennsylvania as well that actually existed before even most of the anti-bullying laws were put in place. The problem with the hazing laws in Pennsylvania as well as in New Jersey is that the people who created those laws only thought of hazing occurring in higher education settings. So those laws need to be extended down into lower grade schools.
So some might argue that milder forms of hazing, you know, you have to get your hair cut a certain way or diet or wear funny clothes for a day, might actually be okay, and that it can increase cohesiveness within a group. Do you agree?
That's a common myth about hazing, Mary, which is that there's such a thing as mild hazing and severe hazing. Hazing is hazing. It's a humiliating, denigrating, exclusive behavior that basically exerts power over those who are vulnerable or younger and makes them do things as the price to pay for being part of or seen as being part of a team or an organization. Hazing is hazing, and on a psychological level, if not a physical level, it's hurtful to those in it. And the saddest part of that myth is that it's completely unnecessary. We have lots of examples, and it's, well, this is a well-studied area, that there's absolutely no need to create those kinds of sort of hurtful rituals and behaviors in order to bond kids or in order to get great performance out of them. I mean, you can get great performance out of people for a while using fear and power and exclusion and threats, but you can get the same exact level of winning performance out of kids and adults as well by using supportive methods of bonding and getting a great performance out of people. So the whole thing is just a myth, the idea that any form of violence, mild or not, is tied to somehow great performance or people bonding together. You know, when adults do heroic things for their teammates or their buddies or their coworkers, they don't do those heroic things because they were subjected to fear and pain and denigration and humiliation. People do those things because out of a sense of positive identity of who they see themselves as. And you could really, if I'm not exaggerating, you could say out of a sense of love. When adults do heroic things, they do it because they care about the other people.
Stuart, I just want to go and get one more point here before we begin to wrap up. And this is back to the law and perhaps tweaking it. Last year, a Ridgewood, New Jersey 15-year-old ended up in a Newark courtroom. His parents were appealing the school board's determination that he'd bullied a female classmate. And the issue was whether he'd called the classmate a horse or whether he'd called her fat. He admits to having called her a horse. But now a record of bullying is on his file. The information has been reported to the state. And his parents said, this is going too far, and they filed an appeal. So was that a commonsensical situation, or solution, I should say, to name calling?
Well, one of the ways that schools have initially reacted to the law was becoming over-focused on single incidents, no matter what those incidents are. And that's one of the things that has to be tweaked in the law. Bullying is almost always, virtually always, a pattern of negative acts. I've been taking phone calls from parents for the last 15 years of kids who have been hurt. And in all those 15 years, I've never gotten a single phone call from a parent in which they said something bad happened to my son yesterday in school, and before that, everything was fine. It's always months to years that these things have been happening. So if a school reacts to a single incident with no history to it and construes that as bullying and takes action accordingly, that's really not ideal. But it's also a side issue.
I was just going to say, not to downplay name calling. I mean, name calling is hurtful and can be a part of bullying. What is the answer there? Is there some sort of a conference with the children, with teachers, mediation session, that sort of thing?
The answer has to do with what we call the culture and climate of the school, which is largely controlled by the adults. In other words, culture is the norms, how we function here, the expectations people have for the kind of place it is. And out of that comes school climate, which is how the place feels to those in it. And when you have a well-run school with a strong culture and a supportive and warm climate, you take care of most of the incidents of bullying that would otherwise arise. And that's really the answer, to run these places properly. The supervision that was missing in the Sayreville locker room is not even about the supervision. It's about the coach's understanding of their responsibility for the way that team functions, its norms. And when you do that well enough, you don't get kids who are seniors hurting kids who are younger.
Stuart, if you could stay with us one more moment or so, I'd like to get to the phones. And Jim mm-hmm. Has a question or a comment from Morrisville, Pennsylvania.
Sure.
Jim,
mm-hmm.
welcome to Radio yeah. Times.
Hey, great topic, great show. I just have two comments. Number one, it's a great law. I'm very much in favor of it. But, you know, schools, they need, you know, it's one thing to have to say to your administrators and your teachers and your coaches, hey, there's anti-bullying, you know, here's a class or here's a handout. But it needs to really do anything right, especially in a school, you need funding. Okay, so, you know, if you're going to pass laws, you got to find a way to fund this stuff. It's not just a matter of having, you know, a session, and with somebody speaking and then the coaches and the teachers go out.
I'd like to answer that, Mary.
Yes.
Because we're going to have to agree to disagree. On one level, I agree. When I authored the report on which the law was based, we wanted funding for this. It's that important. But the other point of view is that this isn't a matter of funding. From my point of view, an advocate's point of view, this is education 101. In other words, a principal, a superintendent, and staff deaf people who don't understand that you have to pay priority attention to the social and emotional status and functioning of the kids in your care. And you have to first and foremost make sure that they feel good and safe inside of school, really shouldn't be running a school and shouldn't be a staff person in education. That's how important this is. This stuff is fundamental. Addressing and preventing and addressing violence is fundamental to everything else you want to do. And there are studies that clearly show that where you pay a lot of attention to these things, you get higher learning, higher test scores. Everything you want from students functions better when you prevent and address violence. And that's not a funding thing. That's an educator 101 kind of basic thing that everybody ought to get, funding or not.
Jim, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Stuart Green, we'd like to thank you for the update on New Jersey's bullying law.
Sure. Thanks, Mary. Appreciate it.
Stuart Green is director of the New Jersey Coalition for Bullying Awareness and Prevention. And joining the conversation now is Elizabeth Allen, professor of higher education at the University of Maine and director of a group called StopHazing.org. Elizabeth, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi there. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. I'd like to get into define hazing a bit further. Stuart and I were talking a little bit ago about whether all hazing is necessarily a bad thing. What do you think?
Yes, I would agree with what Stuart had to say. Hazing is hazing. And, you know, the definition of hazing is any activity that places someone in danger or abuses, degrades, humiliates them in order to become a member of a group. And so by its, you know, very definition, we said that hazing has no place in schools, has no place in our youth organizations. And so, you know, it's not helpful to talk about different levels of hazing or you know, although we can see how hazing can occur on a continuum, to sort of discount the kinds of hazing that involve humiliation and degradation, that's problematic because it diminishes the importance, the harm that can occur because, you know, that can occur through hazing, through a variety of behaviors.
Elizabeth, has there been an increase from your perspective in sexual violence and hazing? Or is it just that in today's culture we're more willing to talk about it?
It's a great question, and we don't really know for sure from a research perspective because we don't have the baseline data to measure, you know, the change over time. We do have some baseline data in 1999. There was a study of varsity athletes conducted out by Nadine Hoover and Norm Pollard out of Alfred University in conjunction with the NCAA. And then I led a study in 2008. So we had about a 10-year comparison there. Our study looked at college students in many different kinds of organizations, but including varsity athletes. And when we looked at the behaviors among varsity athletes, we saw very little change over that time period. But otherwise, we don't have a lot of data to make comparisons. We can see, you know, certainly we're hearing more about it in, you know, the news. And I think that's really important to take note of. I've heard a lot of people speak, understandably, with alarm about the Sayreville case, and some people talk about it being unprecedented. But the reality is we've heard about those same kinds of scenarios occurring time and time again. I mean, if you just do a Google search, you'll find incident after incident over the last, you know, 3 to 5 years.
And Elizabeth, on that point, let's get back to the phones and welcome Nathan to Radio Times. Nathan calls us from South Jersey. Hi, Nathan. You joining us? Are you there?
Yes.
Sorry. Hello, Nathan.
Yeah, I'm here.
Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I'm in now. Okay. Thanks for taking my call. I want to agree with your guest who said that all hazing is damaging. It damages the person who suffers from it. And I've worked with youth groups for most of my adult life, and I had a son who was a high school varsity football player. And my impression was when the Sayreville incident came out was that, sadly, that this is probably not an isolated incident. I had a discussion with my son. He graduated a couple of years ago from high school. And he goes, yeah, of course that stuff goes on. It went on in my high school.
But, Nathan, did it go on to the extent that it went allegedly went on in Sayreville?
Well, he told me that they, you know, a lot of these football programs have summer camps they go to. And he said that his summer camp, all the freshmen were sodomized with broomsticks and things like that and made to be, you know, humiliated. And I said, well, where was the supervision? They said, well, you know, after a certain time, it lights out, they all go to sleep, and the kids are basically unsupervised.
And I
think that there's a kind of, you know, the thing that bothers me the most, especially in the football program, and I didn't realize this until I had a son who was in it, in the high school, at least in New Jersey, and I can't speak for any other state, and I'm in South Jersey, these communities take these high school programs very seriously, and it's not about teaching young athletes about sportsmanship and athletic skill. It's about winning games and getting sponsors and spending money, and there's a lot of secrecy that goes on, and I think, you know, earlier when you were talking with your earlier guests about how the stories keep changing, I know with teenagers, I'm sure that those people that were victimized, the freshmen, they're probably threatened by other upperclassmen, say.
And that's my understanding. Nathan, thank you. Before we let you go, just one quick point. It sounds as if your son was kind of resigned to the hazing.
Well, I think, I think that those kinds of things go on in organizations. And, you know, when I was a teenager, I suffered through hazing. I was not in an athletic side. I was in the music side, so we didn't have hazing to that extent. But I'll tell you, I was in a regional school district, and I came from a feeder district. And when you were a freshman, the freshmen got hazed on the school bus on the first week. It was like hazing week, and we were made to eat raw persimmons, and we got smashed with the good stuff in our hair and things like that. And the bus driver was like, it's fine, just as long as nobody gets hurt, everybody gets hazed. It's just the way it is. And
Nathan, we're up against the clock, so I want to thank you for your call to Radio Times, and Elizabeth will pick up on that point after the break. Elizabeth Allen is professor of higher education at the University of Maine. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowain. More of Radio Times in just a moment. Stay with us. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowain. And we're talking about hazing and bullying this hour on Radio Times. Our guest is Elizabeth Allen, professor of higher education at the University of Maine and director of StopHazing.org. Our lines are open. If you'd like to add to the conversation, here's the number. It's 1-888-477-9499. Email works as well, radiotimes@whyy.org. as does a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. And Elizabeth, again, I'd like to pick up on a point that our caller Nathan made just before the break. There just seemed to be resignation on the part of his son, and I'm sure this young man was not the only one, in terms of the hazing that went on during his sports years, some of which seemed to involve sexual assault. Is this common?
Yes, I think it is. Unfortunately, sadly, I think this is really important, and I'm glad he made the point and that you're following up on it in terms of the fact that hazing is often so normalized. It becomes invisible and to an extent where students don't even see it for what it is. And we found this in our research where students could define hazing. For the most part, they could provide a fairly accurate definition. But when you ask them, you know, had they experienced it directly, even if they had experienced hazing, 9 out of 10 would say no. So when they asked them about the behavior without using the word hazing, they would say they had experienced it. But when you ask them specifically about, you know, have you ever experienced hazing? No, not me. because in their minds, often hazing is just harmless pranks, and they don't see, you know, they don't understand the definition accurately, and that contributes to, you know, part of why people are overlooking it so much. It's been normalized in our culture as just, and you know, people will use euphemisms like, oh no, that wasn't hazing, that was just an initiation, or that was just a tradition, or that was just team bonding, when indeed it was hazing. And I think we have a long way to go in educating people about what hazing is, what it looks like, what to do when it occurs, and how to understand it as connected to bullying, but slightly different from bullying.
Let's talk for a moment about how Central Bucks West High School handled some alleged incidents of hazing not too long ago. During the preseason, some players apparently, allegedly, grabbed the genitals of others. Everyone was clothed. And upon finding out about this, the superintendent canceled the final two games of the season. Michael Smirkanish, a columnist and radio and TV personality and alum of CB West, writes that adults were overzealous. He says the perpetrators should have been singled out and punished. And if their number was such that they couldn't field a team, then they forfeit. But instead, the school, in his opinion, gets a bad rep that lasts forever because of the internet. How do you think about that situation and how it was handled?
Well, I think you could really reframe that in a very positive way, that the leaders of the school took decisive action. They sent a strong and clear message to the community, to the students in the school, that this kind of behavior is not a part of who we are and we're not going to tolerate it. And I think that, you know, shows a leadership. It shows that they care about the students' well-being and about creating a safe school community where students can thrive. I don't think it gives the school a bad rap, the fact that they took strong action.
So how do you prevent it from happening in the first place?
Well, we're trying to figure that out, and I think it's a very complex issue, and like bullying or any form of violence, it takes a lot of different strategies. As was mentioned earlier, a law is important, and policies are important, but they're not sufficient. And so we have to look at many different angles, and we have to look at the individual students who are involved, you know, what kinds of things they're learning about what's okay and what's expected of them in order to become a member of a group. We have to work with the leaders of groups to help them find positive ways to build team unity and cohesion among groups. Some of them are doing it just because it was done to them and they don't know and can't think of other ways, or no one has challenged them or expected them to come up with other ways. And we can do so much more, and I really believe that we can go a long way in terms of preventing hazing by helping people to step up when they are bystanders. There are so many students and adults who know about these things happening, whether they be the bus drivers, as the last caller mentioned, parents, teachers who might overhear something, coaches, et cetera. And I think they have a responsibility, and we all have a responsibility, whether we're, you know, with family members or neighbors or kids we know in the community. We have a responsibility to speak up and step up and ask questions. What's going on here? You know, this doesn't seem right to me. Can you tell me a little bit more about why everyone has their head shaved today, and or why everyone is wearing, you know, these costumes and what's happening there? Because sometimes, you know, what's on the surface is just, you know, just that, only what's on the surface, and there's a lot more going on behind the scenes.
Okay, Elizabeth, I'd like to read a somewhat lengthy email from Ted P. from Claymont, Delaware, but it's really salient. He writes, when I was in high school, most hockey teams in our area had a head shaving party at someone's house the night before the first game, and rookies had to pick up pucks. As we progressed to college, it was pretty much a binge drinking night where many of the veterans drank as much as the rookies. It
seem like initiation has evolved from something silly to build social camaraderie to some sort of imbalance of power to cross over into the ranks of the initiated. He goes on to say, as alumni advisor of my undergraduate fraternity chapter, I feel like it's an uphill battle with the students to resist the urge to make new member activities meaningful and culture building rather than the we had to do it mentality that they feel builds cohesion among the initiatives or the initiative, the initiates. That's the word I'm looking for. What do you think?
Yes, I agree. Right on target, really. I mean, and this is where we need to be having, these conversations about the power dynamics involved in hazing. And that is what it is. It's an abuse of power. And, you know, where many different behaviors can be used as a weapon, so to speak. I mean, people need to see it for what it is. It's not just harmless pranks. It's an abuse of power. And the question he raises is how do we get, you know, people to think beyond that? If that was what, you know, was done to them, or, you know, they're just enacting what they think they're supposed to be enacting. The bottom line is, in most cases with the students that I come into contact with through my research on hazing, most of them are trying to accomplish something positive. Now, that's not always the case. But in many cases, it starts out with goals like, well, we just wanted to maintain a team tradition, or we just wanted to build, you know, some cohesion or group unity. And so we have to work to figure out, okay, how do we accomplish those goals without having to resort to humiliation, degradation, or some other kind of abuse? And it is possible, but it might not always be apparent to the kids and to adults. And I think also helping everyone learn about the different forms of power and how they can operate. I think a lot of kids, I have children myself who are involved in sports and many teams and activities in schools, and they may not always be aware of the power they have in terms of age. They understand it, they feel it, but especially when they don't have the power, but when they're on the upside of the power, when they're the upperclassman or the veteran on the team, it's easy to forget. And so we need to be educating kids at a young age about these kinds of dynamics and how easy it is to not be aware and to allow the group dynamic to take a wrong turn. And they really have to build the skills ahead of time so that when things start to happen like that, they know what to do and they can step up. And it's really, really hard to do if you feel like you're completely alone. But the reality is, most of the time you're not alone. You just feel like you are. Most of the people don't really agree with what's going on. They don't support it. They feel uncomfortable. And if you can just get that one or two people to speak out and step up, others will follow.
All right, let's get to the phones. Rick in Delaware is standing by. Welcome to Radio Times, Rick.
Yes, thank you. It's an interesting conversation. I serve as the alumni advisor for Southern University fraternity house where I graduated. And we've had not at our house, but at different houses. One young man was asked to drink a full bottle of soy sauce, ended up in ER, almost died in a what's called a shake-up. And, you know, one of the things that I find in all of this is the university administrations have a tolerance for it. They say one thing, but actually are not really firm. The president of Cornell has been firm, and now the president of Dartmouth has been firm. No hazing. And they eliminated the pledging cycle. And I look at it as a top-up thing, top-down thing, and a bottom-up thing. You got to educate the students and the coaches, but there also has to be repercussions from the top. If there's hazing, coaches get fired, teams, seasons are closed. And I totally agree with the school administration in Pennsylvania and Bucks County that they closed the school football year, and the same for the school in New Jersey. And I am shocked that Michael Smirkanish would dare say what he did, because I consider him to be a very intelligent man.
Well, and thanks for the phone call to Radio Times, Rick. I think he was saying essentially punish the perpetrators, but not people who weren't involved. But interestingly, though, the young man that Rick speaks of is not the first person to head to the emergency room as a result of hazing. I'm surprised, Elizabeth, that you don't hear more about legal action being taken against institutions of learning, and that would shut things down pretty quickly, lawsuits?
Well, sometimes we do hear about those. I mean, certainly with the Florida A&M case and the marching band case a couple of years ago.
Sure.
Yeah, there's been ongoing legal action there and in a number of other instances as well. And I think that does get the attention of administrators. But there are many, many things that, you know, administrators have to pay attention to. And sometimes this is one where if there hasn't been a very prominent case that's, you know, made the, you know, that's in the public eye, it might not be front and center on the radar screen. And unfortunately, sometimes it's too late by the time, you know, by the time the attention is there, the damage has already been done. And so we're really working to get the word out to administrators, to staff at colleges and universities and in high schools to take action for prevention now. And I'm working, it's interesting the caller mentioned Cornell University. They are on the forefront of hazing prevention. They have visible leadership,
Elizabeth? I think we might have lost the telephone call from Elizabeth Allen, and we will get her back on the line in just a moment here on Radio Time. She is professor of higher education at the University of Maine and director of StopHazing.org. We are talking about hazing this hour on Radio Times, and what we can do to turn things around so that incidents, alleged incidents, such as that which happened in Sayreville, New Jersey, in which seven high school football players were apprehended, three have been charged with aggravated sexual assault, so that this sort of thing can be turned around and that it comes to an end. It is a difficult process. Kids are reluctant to come forward because there is backlash. Some of the freshmen have been vilified on social media in Sayreville, New Jersey. So it is a long process, as we heard from our guest today here on Radio Times. And we will get, hopefully, Elizabeth Allen back up here as soon as possible on Radio Times. One of the things that you're good to go, I hear, Elizabeth. You're back with us. Thank you.
I am.
I just wanted to get one more point in before we wrap up. It's not limited to young people hazing. You know, think the Miami Dolphins last year and Richie Incognito and some others. And teammate Jonathan Martin was harassed so much so that he left the team. And he had said he was bullied to the extent he contemplated suicide. If hazing is not stopped at a young age, do you find that it continues as people get older, people who are involved in it?
So I'm really glad you brought this point up. I think what we really have to look at is not just the individuals involved, but also the fact that how is this part of our culture? And when I talked about the normalization earlier, it's something that's a cultural response to hazing. And so as a culture, as various communities within the culture, we need to work together. I mean, this is a community issue. It's not just an issue of, you know, some bad decision makers, some kids with poor judgment, or, some fraternity gone bad at a particular college or university. It's not that. You know, I think I like to quote Tim Marshall from Cornell University. He talks about it's not the bad apples so much. I mean, we have some of those, but it's the barrel the apples are in. And
sure.
So we have to look at the broader culture and what are the kinds of things that contribute to creating environments where hazing is more likely to occur.
Elizabeth, hazing, I'm going to have to stop you there because we're up against the clock. Thank you so much for joining us. Elizabeth Allen is director of StopHazing.org. And if you'd like to learn more about Radio Times, visit our Facebook page. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowain today. Thanks for tuning in. Hour 2 is coming right up.